Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What happens when a long-form video game experience goes wrong? I don't mean when it becomes less fun, like a clunky midpoint in a grindy open-world game, but when the very idea of playing something becomes sickening and without pleasure. What do you do when a game you love becomes a game you don't ever want to return to? Those are the words of Cameron Kunzelman, our longtime contributor, in a column called I Played a Favorite Game Long Enough to Start Hating It. This sucks. I'm Danielle Riendo. This is Waypoint Radio, episode 138. Joining me today are Austin Walker.
Hey, it's me. It's Austin Walker.
And Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
So this topic spoke near and dear to my heart as somebody who... I think I'm sort of like constantly chasing the dragon of like favorite game experiences. And there are so few games that like really, really, really do it for me that I keep playing them over and over and over again. I don't know if that makes me weird. I don't know if that makes me abnormal in the gaming world.
I think that's the norm for a lot of people, right? It's like, that's my fave. Like, I know people who like replay Link to the Past every year or something like that, right?
That's kind of nice. And I guess this is sort of what happens when that goes wrong. When you've gone back to that well too many times, and now all you can see is like the imperfections. All you can see are the seams. I'm not going to talk about
isn't
it too
like
much.
Cameron, oh, yeah, go ahead. Cameron's piece, though, in particular, though, is like we should like set up like what he's saying, like about like so he's talking about a game, Baldur's Gate, which was one of his favorites, and then not only that, he was doing a YouTube series in which they were slowly, methodically going through the game, breaking it down, analyzing it, and you know, like the Christmas piece is like in pursuit of doing that, realized. You know, he had kind of exhausted everything out of the game, and so I think it's a little different than playing a game a million times, and then like suddenly like it's not fun anymore. Like it's certainly a little different when you're like treating it as an academic paper, and then all of a sudden like shit, maybe there's not as much here as I thought, and I've kind of like kind of exhumed the well a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. This is not like an everyday case, of course, of this sort of phenomenon, and so I think we can also sort of like. It broaden this, because it's not an everyday case, we can broaden this also to hitting something like a plateau in a game and being like, I'm done now. I've got what I need out of this. I'm going to stop so I don't start to hate it. Right. Kind of knowing
that
where
was
that line
like
is.
Like me in like Overwatch, I think.
Sure.
Which was like, all right, I'm not going to, there's never going to, I think I wrote about this at the time, which was like, I don't know at the time, but I think it was when they announced a new character. I said like, hey, this new character, maybe Cameron actually wrote about this. One of us wrote.
I'm pretty sure Cameron wrote this too. But
was
like,
hey, this I game is, this character looks cool, but it's not going to get me to play more Overwatch. And it was also Cameron, but I agreed with it because I'd hit a point where it was like, oh, okay, like I think this game is really cool, but if I keep playing it, I'm going to see my own limits and I'm not in a place where I can put in the time to get better. And that means that I'm going to start hating it and hating myself and feeling bad. And so I'm going to stop. And I think that's true for me in a lot of multiplayer games.
Yeah.
That's kind of what made Battlegrounds such an exception for me last year was I got over that hump. I could feel the self-improvement. And instead of quitting, like not rage quitting, but kind of like quiet, resigned quitting for fear of hating it and hating myself, I kept with it. And that was pretty nice. That's like the opposite of Cameron's thing in some respects. But yeah.
Knowing where to draw that line could be such a skill.
But I do think you're right that there are a bunch of different ways that this happens. So the like there is the Cameron specific, I've mined this thing for so long that now I can't, there's nothing there for me to mine anymore. There is the like burnout, the like this is all I do all day, like that you hear from people who play MOBAs all the time or from people who play MMOs, and it's like I lived in this MMO for a year, I'm done with it. And then there's like the plateau, which is like I think I got it. I think I got what I want. And I think I definitely fall into those different camps and for different games.
Yeah. I remember with Overwatch, for me, it was essentially like when the concept of the meta became like relevant to playing the game. Like, for most people listening to this probably understand the idea of the meta, but like the meta is, you know, like general strategies that are being played out by everyone. And like, if you want to like participate and like do well, it's like you should be paying attention to like where like the stream is going. And at that point was like, I like this game. It was on like my top 10 list because it got me to play like 80 hours of a type of game that is normally not my thing. But when it started to become like new characters, like having to read up on like meta strategies and like who I should be playing, I was just like, this is, I see the hill and I just don't want to climb it. It's not to say that the hill isn't worth climbing. It was just, I got what I wanted out of this game and didn't want to continue scaling it to continue getting what I was getting out of it. And so it was enough. It was like, all right, I got my 60 hours and like, that's fine. Like, I just didn't need to go any further with that particular game.
I have a very weird problem where I just, if I latch onto something, I will pretty much latch onto it for a long ass time, even if I hate it. Even if I hate myself for playing it, even if I hate it.
Why?
I had this with Dark Souls 3 for sure. I like really, really loved it, and then I got super, super stuck. I got stuck on a boss for 15 hours in game. It was horrifying. And then I ripped through like the next 2/3 of the game in like a day. And then I just had to stop.
What was the boss you got stuck on?
Oh god, the fucking Abyss Watchers.
Oh, they're a hard fight.
Oh, I hate
that's
them.
They're in Farron Darkwood. They're my favorite boss in the game. My favorite boss in not because they're like easy, not because like I've said this before, but like, in fact, I said it on the Bonfire Side chats, which is a great Dark Souls focused podcast.
Oh,
people should listen to
all
it.
Oh, those fuckers. They're great.
I love them so much as just like a summation of the ethics of Dark Souls, the ethos of Dark Souls, the themes of Dark Souls. Yeah. But yeah, I could totally get
that's
just, like,
a hard fight,
they can
though.
Kiss my ass.
Yeah, it's a hard fight.
I had a similar. I remember playing Bloodborne, which I was reviewing, so I was playing it ahead of launch and ahead of like being able to like bring in. I mean, generally, I play the Souls games as solo. Like, I it's not that I haven't brought in other players, but like I tend to try and stick to it. Personally, I find it satisfying to try and do it solo. But I remember the closest I got to breaking on Bloodborne was the I can't remember the name of the boss, but it's when you're fighting three at once.
In the woods. I know what you mean.
Which one is it? Wait.
In the woods, there's three of them. They have like snake. They turn into snakes.
Not the witches?
No, not the witches. They turn into snake faces. Like snake head guys.
The shadows. But it's sort of like it's the shadows of Yharnam.
Yes.
The shadows of Yharnam?
I think so.
Yes.
Maybe?
Yes.
It's something like that for sure.
Yeah. No, spoilers for Natalie. Sorry. That's a cool fight.
It is a cool fight.
But it's also tough because it gets harder as you fight. Yeah. Like, in some ways, it's like, I mean, the Abyss Watchers also does that, but that was definitely the thing of, like, there's an order to try to take them out that makes it easier, depending on who you take out first, second, and third. But that's a tough one. That's a toughie. I think Bloodborne's actually one of those games that is another game that I stopped playing. I didn't do all the optional bosses. I didn't 100% that game because if I did, I would have hated it. Because I had such a weird.
You knew where the line was.
I knew where the line was. Like, I was like, all right, I'm going to. I did like the true ending, but I didn't do a lot of the side bosses. Not a lot of. I didn't do some of the hardest side bosses because I just got what I needed from it. And if I had tried to throw myself against some of those bosses, it would have just broken it for me.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. If I latch, I will latch for real. And if I don't latch at all, it'll be like 45 minutes. And I'm like, I'm done. I see what's going on here. Mm-hmm. I'm cool. No thanks. Which I almost feel is like I only have the extremes. Like, I don't have any nice middle ground with this sort of thing. Like, it's either I'm in it to win it, baby, even if I hate myself and I hate every second, like with The Witness. Or it's, I played an hour. Whatever. I'm never going to touch this again. I mean, I had that with, like, Destiny 2. I played that first hour of the game, and I was like, nice. This is nice. Cool.
And then you're out.
There's no latch. There was no latch. I need to, like, latch my claws. I guess I'm a cat because I have to latch my claws into things. But it's a weird thing. It's a very weird thing. I've been playing Bioshock again. I won't talk about Bioshock too much, but That's a game that I have played like 11 times now, something like that. I'm somebody who plays games over and over again, as we all know. And of course, that's the kind of game where the seams certainly show after your first playthrough. It doesn't even take, you know, 10 years for that to sort of show up. That game is all theater. It's 100% theater. It's easy to look behind the curtains if you want to. And I've been playing it again with an eye towards basically trying to make it more of an immersive sim than it actually is by, like, tricking all the systems to kind of fight for me. And I've been getting a little frustrated with how much it's not, like, a very deep immersive sim. Mm-hmm. It's like a shooter with some immersive sim dressing on top. And so all the places where it was obvious that there was a deeper game here, like the way the lighting works, it was rigged in such a way that it was going to actually be a system where you could affect the pressure in given rooms and make it low pressure, high pressure, medium pressure, and that would affect explosions certain currents worked and all sorts of stuff. And so now I'm like sort of seeing the lighting and seeing the way the lighting works, and I'm like, man, I sure wish I could affect the pressure in this room.
That's pretty specific. That's like,
it is,
it's like,
but that's me.
But that's like, also games. That's also revisiting old games with a new perspective, which maybe isn't a thing we've spoken about, which is like I imagine going back to one of those other Monster Hunter games. Like, obviously I didn't play those games, but I could imagine being someone who played those games 5 years ago and then went back after World without some of the kind of
quality of life improvements.
Yes. Or even going back to
or even dual analog stick support, which, like, as part of a story that I wrote up on Monday.
That's a huge one.
Was I'm writing about this disabled player that, you know, is really enjoying Monster Hunter and explaining why specifically he was able to get into World. It was interesting to go back and watch the way people used to play Monster Hunter, which, if people aren't aware, like, became popular as a PSP game before it became popular as a 3DS game. When Nintendo kind of like gotten cahoots with Capcom over the series. And on the PSP, there wasn't two analog sticks. There was a analog nub in the bottom left-hand corner of the PSP, and then the D-pad up above that, and then there was, you know, the traditional PlayStation buttons on the right. But that was a game that you needed to manipulate the camera and move around at the same time, and so people had this claw maneuver, which was, you really have to look it up to see how it works, but basically they have to create like a weird claw configuration of their hand in order to play it, and it's just, I don't know how
and
people played that
game. That hurts to just think about. That's so painful. But it is interesting. It's also one of those things that's adjacent to this, which is the things you're willing to do for a game you love. Like, the things you're willing to put yourself through, the pain you're willing to sort of encounter and endure to play something that you love. I know we were kind of talking about this a little bit, and I don't know if this is, like, a pain point for you, Patrick, but I know you were mentioning Spelunky and your, like, quest with Spelunky and being kind of done with it once you kind of finished up that, you know, self-inflicted... I wouldn't call it a wound, but like a self-inflicted.
I love Spelunky. Spelunky is a game that is probably, you know, one of my top five favorite games of all time. It's like when we talk about games that are perfect, I think that is a bad measure. But actually, if you put a gun to my head, I would say like Spelunky is like pretty close to a perfect game, whatever that means. And yeah, like when I was playing that at Giant Bomb, like I was playing it on stream, and like the whole idea was like to try and, you know, illustrate the process of like learning and like talking through it and showing the whole process of a learning curve. And part of that was like putting a goal on it, but also, you know, like I needed the video feature to end at some point, but I needed something to work towards. And, you know, that game, Spelunky, you can beat in two ways. You can finish the normal run, and then there's sort of a secret run that gets you to a secret world called Hell that's like the quote unquote true ending. Once I'd done that, I mean, there are plenty of reasons to play Spelunky. Like, there are different variants on Spelunky. You know, there's the daily challenge where it's like, you know, everyone's working the same thing. And I did that for a while playing against Chris Remo, although it was mostly me playing Chris Remo, less Chris Remo playing against me. It was mostly if I beat his score, I would talk shit about it. I don't know that Chris Remo cared all that much about trying to beat mine. But it got to the point where someone did create a Twitter bot that was scrubbing... or scraping the leaderboards and was tweeting out like whether I beat Chris Remo or whether Chris Remo beat me.
So good.
It was one of my favorite bits of that whole thing. When I completed Hell, when I made it through that, I felt like a tangible sense of aha, like I did it. And there were other ways to play that. Like, I after I did that, I actually went back and I tried to do some of the other variants. Like, there was an achievement for called Speedlunky, which is where you just try and get through the game as fast as possible, which is both a speedrun variant, and also there was an achievement that I think is beating the game in less than 5 minutes. And I actually did it on the PC and the PSP version. But I was sort of like, I realized at a certain point, I'm looking for something that's not here anymore.
Yeah.
Like my passion for it was just gone. Like, it's a game I love. It's a game that I enjoy, like, going back to every once in a while. Like, we've done it on several streams on Waypoint at various points when we've been together in the same office. But, it's just not there anymore for me. Like, I got to the top of the mountain. I put my flag and I was like, all right, like, I'm done.
Good to go.
Like, I'm good. Like, and that's not, there's nothing to say about the game. Like, the game still has plenty to offer, and I know people that have gone on to keep playing the game for dozens or hundreds of hours, but, like, for me, like, I just felt like the fire extinguished. It was just like, cool. Like, I did it. Like,
done.
I can go play something else. And and that doesn't happen for a lot. Like, that doesn't happen for every game, but for that particular game, like, some games it's just the credits, and then for Spelunky it was, like, something. I mean, there are credits at the end of
Hell. You found other things. Yeah. The thing that I think about a lot, and this maybe goes back to Cameron's thing, is that, I mean, so it's funny because you say, like, oh, it's different what you did versus what Cameron does, where Cameron, like, digs into Baldur's Gate for this academic angle again and again and again. But, like, you set new goals for yourself inside of Spelunky to keep yourself with it because you loved it.
Sure. You're
like, okay, well, next I'm going to do this. Next I'm going to do this. And then eventually you sit at the bottom line. It's a different thing than, like, okay, I'm going to find the, you know, what this means deeply or what this says about justice or something like that. But I do think the one of the interesting things that kind of separates two different things out are you hitting bottom or are you finding cracks that you wish you didn't see? And it sounds like in Spelunky you were just hitting bottom. You just hit the bottom, you played through it all, you're done with it. But I think about something like – I think about some games that I love and have written about why I love them and stuff like that. Something like Far Cry 2, which is one of my favorite games still. But it's one of those games that as I revisit it as a writer and replay it, the things that excited me about it when it launched don't excite me about it in the same way. Or they still excite me. But I can also see on top of those really good things, different perspectives from which a firmer critique can emerge. Where, like, so, like, one of the things that I this was, like, a big thing for me years ago was when I first played it, I loved it, and I think I fell into the trap of talking about realism, which is, I think, a trap a lot of critics fall into. It's like, oh, this game is so realistic. Oh, the guns break. You have malaria. The fights are really hard. And that's a thing that we say about a lot of games. Like, oh, it's so realistic. It just came up with Kingdom Come, right? Whatever the third thing in that name. Kingdom Deliverance. It's like, oh, it's so realistic. This aspiration of realism. But there are lots of ways in which these games will continue to be unrealistic, and that is a limiting factor to what we can say about them. So for Far Cry 2, one of the big things was, like, there are no civilians in that game except for the ones who are always locked up in a safe place, who you can talk to. You, like, walk through a door and then your gun disappears and no one can ever hurt them, or those tied directly to specific story missions. And those people are, like, the very intro leaving the country. It's like, okay, well, this depiction of a place of civil war in civil war doesn't really have any people in it. I mean, it has lots of people, but mostly it has mercenaries. It just has, like, this proxy war happening separate from any sort of, like, actual armed conflict between residents of the place or more importantly, people who live there, civilians who live there who aren't involved, who are being put in danger. And so you go, well, what's happening there? What does this vision of Africa look like? What is this specific vision of an unnamed African country meant to evoke? And so, like, when you revisit something, some things you love, and I still love Far Cry 2, but one of the things that ends up happening is you go, okay, obviously Far Cry is on my mind a lot. There's a lot of Far Cry 5 covers that I just did. So, but you end up thinking, okay, this thing is compromised in some way, or this thing that I hoped would support my reading actually doesn't support it the way I hoped it would under further investigation. And then you have to end up making a call, which is like, do I toss out this read that I've been talking about for years, or do I just, like, pretend not to see that stuff? And I always side on the former, which is like, I want to complicate what my position is. But I've definitely been tempted in the past when I've been playing a game that I've loved to, like, let me just ignore the bad parts. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
Like, let me just, I don't want this thing. We get emails from people and tweet. I'm sure you both get tweets and DMs about this from people too, who say like, I really love X, but it has this problematic element. Am I allowed to love it? And I'm like, the thing I almost always write back and then I stop myself is like, well, I'm not a priest, so I can't give you confess. I can't, you know, tell you to go say three Hail Marys and to donate $20 to the Southern Poverty Law Center. But like, but do that one. But more importantly, like, what I really just want from people is to engage with that stuff. And it doesn't always have to be about problematic content either. It can be like, so a game that I love is FTL, another game we've been talking about recently because of Subsets Into the Breach. And in that game, I never really had the problem that a lot of people had when it came to the final boss. Because early on, through a combination of watching other people play and doing my own strategies, I always knew how to get a ship ready for the final boss. For people who don't know, the final boss in FTL is like it's a really tough challenge that has some like things you need to do. You have to have a cloaking device, you have to have or a really good shields, blah 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 blah. And I got that strategy in my head so early that I never dealt with it. But going back to it now, I can see the ways in which after I've heard so many people say that was a problem for them, I can see the ways in which the game itself doesn't necessarily teach you that. And that's been pretty interesting too. So sometimes it's not even playing it a lot myself. It's seeing other people play it, talking to other people, and their experiences make going back and continuing to play something really tough. Fallout New Vegas is another one
there
of these, which is like at the time, Fallout New Vegas is my favorite Fallout game, full stop. But at the time, because of the way I played the game, I didn't see how any of the like Kaiser's Legion stuff wrapped up because I never went that route. So I never felt like there was any like both sidesism going on, which now I've seen some people make really good cases about that stuff. I didn't play all of the DLC, which means that there is some stuff with like native representation that is really shitty and I just didn't see it.
Sure.
And so it's sometimes like, okay, like this is one of my favorite games and also it has problems. And so it's like, I'm glad to go back to it now with those things in mind, because for now at least it doesn't ruin those games for me so much as it brings out different perspectives to dig into, which is fun.
The interesting thing about that is whether there's a big difference between seeing that after the fact, seeing those problems after the fact, or encountering them or not encountering them, but like hearing someone else encountering it as you're playing it. Does that color your first read, or is that just, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. Like,
'cause I wonder if there's like almost a certain safety in I've had my first experience, my first magical experience. Then I go back and I'm open to seeing the problems versus I'm in the magic.
And while
I don't necessarily want to hear it. Not that you're
blinders
saying,
on.
Oh, I'm not listening to you. But a little bit more, you know, kind of open to whatever.
No, I mean, like, here's one that definitely came up for me was like, I was still very much in the magic when the Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild transphobia hit.
Yes.
And I think that like I definitely should have been more vocal about that. Like, I think, you know, we ran a couple of articles that touched on it.
Yeah.
We talked about it on the podcast, but it didn't make it into my review, and it didn't make it into my review because I just wasn't in the. My review was just such a bad, like, glowing piece. I like was so in awe that it like really bleeds through in that piece of the entire thing instead of zooming into areas where it could have improved, and that's a big, big spot where it could have improved. And so that was one of those moments of like, all right, I have to – once it hit and once people like really spoke about it, it was like, this is not going to ruin this game for me. It's not going to erase the positive times I have, but I have to take seriously these real issues that have real effects on people. And there are ways in which you can build alibis and you can say like, well, I have friends who think it's okay, and like that's a shitty thing to do. And like, again, like in general, I know when I have that impulse and I try to correct for it.
Yeah.
I obviously people make mistakes, but like I definitely think that's one of those things of like when you're enjoying something, do your best to onboard, to bring on the sort of like whatever criticisms in the air. Think about it while you're playing through, or at least for me, that actually does make it more enjoyable, but maybe not in that same way as the like blinders on and not paying attention to anything way. Which I wonder, one of the games that I wonder about a lot is BioShock Infinite, that was received.
I was just going to say, like, I remember when I played through that game, I can't remember if I had it pre-release or, you know, certainly right around the same time, but that's a... I, I wasn't particularly high on that game when I went through it, but I will be perfectly honest that it wasn't because of the game's politics. It's because I played through it and viewed it purely through the lens of a sci-fi story and just had like really like yeah. big problems with like the way it ends. But and it was and I viewed that game from start to finish when I was playing it as a science fiction story and just wasn't really paying attention to the game's like politics and what it was saying. You know, and it's both sidesism and all that stuff. That was something that was informed upon, beating the game and then seeing that sort of, like, discourse turn that happened where a lot of the initial reviews, like, very much focused on its, like, sci-fi trappings. And I think I could see why people looked at that game and saw it in a more positive lens through that way. And I just wasn't thinking of it. And that was part of the value of the criticism and the essays and all the discussion about that game mm-hmm. afterwards was like, oh, right. Like, I just wasn't even, one, wasn't picking up on stuff. Two, wasn't paying attention to stuff. And that, like, turned my entire viewing of that game, like, around. I wasn't positive. Like I said, I wasn't super positive on it. But I definitely wasn't coming away with certain observations that upon, like, retrospectively, it's like, oh, shit. Like, yeah, like, you're right. Like, that was fucked. Like, huh. Like, I didn't even look at that scene in that way yeah. because I was worried about, like, what's going on with this portal over here.
Right, right. Yeah. That was a really interesting time.
So that was a game
I
had that particular, yeah.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah. Right, sorry. We're having, like, some people listening, if this sounds weird in the edit, there's a big storm in New York right now, so Patrick's, like, voice is
little
weird
robot.
For us sometimes. Yeah. And we talk, if there's any crosstalk, blame whatever the name of this storm is.
Blame the weather.
I'm curious, because both of you were actually at major outlets yeah. at the time. I was a freelancer. I was doing blogging still, mostly, like, free blogging on my own website. Cameron was also in the same position at that point, doing some freelancing. He actually collected, like, 30 different pieces of BioShock criticism at the time that were like, here's – the discourse is here. This is what people are saying about BioShock Infinite. But at the time, from the outside, it looked like one of those moments where it wasn't clear that the major sites – had people in place who could engage with those ideas or who were encouraged to engage with those ideas. And it felt so much like people were taking Levine at his word
oh, yeah.
that it was a game that dealt with issues maturely. And like it was really frustrating. And I say that now being on the other side where I know all about practical reasons why you don't have more staff members and blah, 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 blah. But I just, I'm curious what your perspectives are from the inside, seeing that critical backlash, even if the wide response was really positive.
Yeah, it was very weird. It was weird for me, especially because I had friends who worked on that game, and I had known bits and pieces. Nobody ever was able to talk about things until much later on, but I knew bits and pieces about like who was developing a drinking problem because of working on this game, and what was going on with this, and who was being demoted, and so on and so forth. So it was very weird. And it was also my like second week at Polygon or third week at Polygon, and it was GDC week, and I remember being in the video editing suites. There, sort of helping to cut the video itself, the video review itself of the game. So I had no idea what happened in the game other than like shots here and shots there. And I was like, wow, this sure looks interesting. I can't wait to play it. So I was like excited when it first came out. I was so excited knowing the things that I knew and reading the review before it came out. I was like, wow, this sounds like it really deals with things in a very mature way. Can't wait to play that. And then I played it and it was... what it was.
Were you playing it before or after the criticism curve?
Just after.
Okay.
Or not the curve itself, but like I played it that week.
Right, okay.
But after the reviews were out. After gotcha. I knew certain things about the game and had seen like, oh, this shot of this happening was right. in the review. And I was like, wow, that's fascinating. Right. How cool. The really weird thing is that I might play it again soon because it's,
are you going through?
I'm going through the, I might go through the whole collection. I'm definitely playing two, no question. But I might actually play, it's 5 years after Infinite, this month. It is 5 years after Infinite. And I am very interested to see, I suspect that the 2013 both sidesism will have aged even more poorly than we think. It's sort of my suspicion.
Probably.
But yeah, Patrick, I don't know what your experience was there being.
Well, I think like a lot of people are just like really underread. Like right. One, it's like not thinking about games in that perspective. But I also think, and this is like, I you know, at Giant Bomb, I work with a lot of really smart people, and like a lot of hours with really smart people. But I think what was illustrative of that, like those two different divergent paths of reacting to that game was not even necessarily that the people that wrote certain types of reviews of Bioshock Infinite couldn't have written more critical reviews. I just think a lot of people were like thinking about games that way, thinking of those topics, reading about like racism, both sidesism. Like, I just think people really underread on a lot of that stuff. So I think a lot of people just didn't even have necessarily the rhetorical or critical or analytical tools to think of it. And games like that and moments like that were very instructive, both in my own personal development of like that, reading those critical analysis and seeing my own blind spots was like, oh shit, all right, like I need to be okay, I need to like read up on this stuff and like see why people are pointing out things this way, because this is stuff I want to talk about. And if I missed that on my own like critical read through of this game, like that says something about me. Doesn't mean I can't get better, but it also means like I missed it the first time around, and I can blame that partially on the sci-fi trappings to some extent, but to another extent it's like I just didn't have the tools, and I just didn't see that shit coming. And like, that's on me. And I think that game was an example, yes, of like a lack of sort of a certain amount of diversity, but a certain amount of intellectual diversity at different outlets. And I do think like that was a moment for a lot of people to like rethink, like, ah, like how do I even look at these games, and like what do I need to be more well read on if I want to kind of bring that eye to it? Because I think that was that. There are a few games in which the sort of like the change in reaction to the game was as 180 as Bioshock Infinite was.
Right. Totally.
And 5 years ago there were even fewer writers of color at major websites. So I feel like that can't be discounted. Or folks who were not in positions of actual power in terms of like reviewing. Typically, it's just to give you a tiny bit of background if you're unfamiliar with this, but like if you were like a junior reviewer or a staff writer, you weren't going to get Bioshock Infinite as a review. You were going to get maybe a smaller game to review, that kind of thing. But like the big games, the AAA games, kind of went to, you know, whoever was like in charge of reviews in some cases, or somebody who'd been there for a very long time. So if there was a staffer of color or a staffer who was maybe a little more up on these issues, they probably weren't the one to review that game at a big publication.
Right, right.
So.
Cool. That's how things were. It's so funny because like you think about 5 years is a long time in terms of the color and shape of the industry, in terms of like where Polygon was at the time, in terms of where sites like Giant Bomb were in terms of representation, and sites sites like IGN even, where I think a lot of times folks in the spheres that we are in do like the sort of broad dismissal of very mass audience focused sites like IGN. But if you look at their talent pool, if you look at like who is doing reviews there, who their editors are, it's diversified a lot in the last few years and has become a pretty strong pool of writers. And partly, you know, I'm a pretty down in the dumps dude. I'm a pretty like change is so slow and so easily countered that it's hard to get excited about it. But I mean, I think about 5 years ago, me writing about Bioshock Infinite as a critic, and I wasn't even like a super hot take. Like my takes were all pretty mild in terms of what their interests were. Like I was deep in my academic mode, and so it was about things like level design and also like a weird letter about crisis and disaster around boardwalks because I'm from a boardwalk area in Jersey. Yeah. And like, you know, and there was one about agency and representation, but those were like some of the pieces that got me an early audience as a freelancer and as a critic, and like started to build my audience. And that helped. That happened with I think a lot of people in that time and space. And then there was a knock on effect from that, from the way that myself and some other critics were able to all open other doors for other people. I've said it before, but like I wouldn't be here without Cameron Kunzelman, who is the one who invited me to co-write a piece with him at Paste. And like that was my first major freelance gig after years of being out of the game. And that is like the a sort of weird thing around these things, which is like these games that to go back to them, you'd hate them. To replay them is to suffer. Can also if you know, can also be catalyzers of change and effect, because now you look at Kotaku's makeup, you look at a lot of the industry's makeup. It's still not perfect. There are still serious issues. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like absolutely, and I still think there's a long way to go in general. Because
it'd be awesome if we had a trans writer.
It would be fantastic if we had. I would love to hire. You know, that would be fantastic. And that's not a choice. That's the thing that sucks about that is not like. We're choosing not to do that. Right. That's a resources thing, which speaks to a larger question about where media is at, which we've been lingering on for months now, and speaks to it speaks to how slow change can be, which can be really frustrating and demoralizing. But you know, at least BioShock Infinite isn't coming out this year. Instead, we're getting Far Cry 5, another game that seems to be hedging its bets and playing both sides. We'll see. I haven't played all that game. I played 3 hours of it. There's a big preview and a big interview on the site. Go look at those.
Yeah.
Worth checking out.
Those are up today. I think we have time for one question. I know you have a heart out.
I have a heart out in like 3 minutes, let's say.
All right, 3 minutes. All right, I'll just read this question. It's adjacent. I've said that like 10 times. I apologize.
Oh, that's the hot new SJW word, by the way. Have you heard that adjacent?
SJW.
SJWs. Y'all should take a look at how many SJWs are saying adjacent these days.
It's a nice word.
Have you heard how Daniel Klepek has been saying adjacent lately?
Oh my
All
god.
Right, sorry, let's keep
cock.
Oh, cock.
We are
All right,
in this, a world.
This comes from Cassie. This is a nice question. This is a good question, and I think it is related to the things we're talking about today. Hi, White Point. I was reminded of this strange phenomenon while watching your Bloodborne streams. There are a lot of games out there that I really love and admire, but will never really play. The Last of Us and Bloodborne topped that list for me. For whatever reason, despite many attempts, I just really bounced off these games. I still recommend them to other friends and have a fondness for them as if I had experienced the games firsthand. To be more specific, I never made it out of Boston with Ellie during any of the 3 or 4 attempts I made to play The Last of Us because I hated, thoroughly despised, the combat controls, and dying made me genuinely angry. So one weekend, my roommate and I locked ourselves in a room, and I watched her play through the entire game in almost one sitting. I came out loving the game, and now it's definitely one of my favorites, even though I've never really played it. Do you have any games that were a chore or were actively unpleasant to play yourself, but you ended up loving them for some reason? Thanks, Cassie. I love this question.
Yeah.
What are your
answers here?
I have this relationship with some of the Dark Souls games that I haven't played yet. It's not that I haven't – that I'll never play them. I never played 1 or 2, but I really enjoy watching like speedruns for them. I just really enjoy watching that kind of thing. There's a lot of speedruns I enjoy watching even though I've never played the game. That a lot of older games like Jedi – the 1996-ish LucasArts game that's like Jedi Assault.
Wait, what is it? What's it do?
It's a third-person Star Wars game. Very well-beloved. Jedi Academy,
Jedi Knight 2. Dark Forces 2, Jedi Knight, Jedi Academy. There's a lot of,
one of those
Star Wars games that have Jedi
really
in the title.
Like
we really got to know which one you
watching
mean.
Watching it, I think it's Jedi Academy.
Okay.
I think it's Jedi Academy.
Who do you play as?
You're not Dash Rendar.
Are you Kyle Katarn?
Yes, Kyle
Katarn.
That's
probably Jedi. That's either Dark Forces 2, Jedi Knight, or it's Jedi Outcast, Dark Forces 3. But it's probably not. It's probably. It could be Jedi Academy, but you make your own character in Jedi Academy. So you're not Kyle Katarn.
I have a much better one. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Half-Life 2. I cannot play that game.
Oh, yeah,
I have tried playing that game like 75 times. I always die. I suck at it so much. But I sure love watching Robert Yang play through the whole thing.
I love watching Robert Yang play through anything, though.
I mean, that's pretty much true.
That's just it.
But that game in particular, I've never been able to really play it, but I sure enjoy watching that game.
So. My most recent example is Horizon, which is a game that I have a lot of. I, you know, a barista will say, "Oh, hey, I just got a PS4. What should I play?" I'm like, "Oh, Horizon's pretty good, even
it's good
though
for
it's
baristas.
Not. It's great for baristas. Are you? What are you? You're a barista? You should play Horizon. Zero Dawn.
Yeah.
you have Aloy's haircut already, so
there you go.
That's a situation where it's like, I know I didn't like that game for a lot of reasons that I stand by,
yeah.
but also think that it has a sort of broad appeal for people who like are coming from the Assassin's Creed games in the last generation, or like who like open world action games in general. And so that's one of those things where it's like, oh yeah, that's a game you could play. Like, but it's really hard when someone's like, what should I play? Like, I don't know. My taste,
what do you like?
I'm not going to say Dragon's Dogma because you're going to hate it and then be mad at me. I'm trying not to get people mad at me right now. I'm already getting them mad.
To get your coffee.
I'm just trying to get my coffee, yeah. Jessica.
Jessica.
Sorry, not your Jessica, Patrick. Not your. So I have a. It turns out your daughter is a barista in Brooklyn now,
yep.
and I know she sounded like she was sick earlier. I hope she's doing okay because I'm really going
to
need
she's
my grande
out of the house
soy latte
to
later.
Make coffee.
Yeah,
that's what it is.
I hope she's on shift because she makes it extra hot. I need it extra hot. That's what I'm,
you know.
I don't even drink. So
babies
anyway,
are good at that.
I have to go. Y'all can finish this off.
All right.
I'm curious what your answers are, so I'm going to listen later.
Patrick, but, do you have one of these where you've really enjoyed sort of watching it or reading about it and it's not necessarily something you play?
Your video is skipping all over the place. I'm going to punt on this question. I cannot answer it because of the tech problems.
Oh, no. All right. Patrick will answer that question in another form because we're going to close things out.
Okay.
maybe we'll save this one. We'll table this one. We'll do it at another time. Everyone, thank you so much for listening to us. As always, if you have questions, you can send it to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. Shout out to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. We're on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice and YouTube at Waypoint Vice. You can find Patrick at Patrick Kleppick because he probably still can't hear me, and that's okay. I'm at Danielle Rye, and Austin is at Austin_Walker. Thank you, everyone. You've been wonderful. I want you to be good and be good at it.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.